President Abbas, you are my partner in peace. And it is up to us, with the help of our friends, to conclude the agonizing conflict between our peoples and to afford them a new beginning.
We will spare no effort and will work diligently and tirelessly to ensure that these negotiations achieve their goals and objectives in dealing with all of the issues: Jerusalem, refugees, settlements, borders, security, water, as well as the release of all our prisoners.
Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, Palestinian Prime Minister Mahmoud Abbas through a translator. They are meeting at the White House today, invited by President Obama, to launch a new round of peace talks with a one-year timetable. Now, the conventional wisdom is that they are too politically weak and too far apart for anything to happen. However, there are spots of unconventional wisdom that say conditions may in fact be more favorable to Middle East peace today than many think. So back with us now to search for that common ground are Rami Khoury, public policy professor at the American University in Beirut and a columnist at the Daily Star there, and David Makovsky, director of the Project on the Middle East Peace Process at the Washington Institute for Near East Policy. David and Rami, always good to have you on WNYC. Hello.
Great to be with you, Brian.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
David, an article in the Times today says Netanyahu is actually in a very strong position politically to take some risks right now. No one could challenge him for the leadership, and he could swap some far-right support in the legislature for some center-left support if he needs to take a controversial step. How much do you think that's the case?
I think it is true. The problem he had was in 1998, when the last time he tried this idea out. It was called the Y River Agreement, and he was willing to lose some on the right, and he thought he would gain more on the liberal side. In the end, he lost the right, and the liberals didn't join him, and he lost power. So I think this time he's going to want to make sure he has an ironclad deal with the Palestinians before he relinquishes the right, and he will try to make sure in advance that he has some ironclad support from the center-left Kadima Party, which has, as you point out, 28 seats in the 120-member Knesset and would be supportive of this. So I think he's in a good position, but he's a bit traumatized by the last time he tried the same strategy.
Rami, Netanyahu is not historically a two-state solution kind of guy. Do you think he is capable of a land for peace exchange?
Well, I think in theory, yes. I think the problem is not just with Netanyahu. The whole problem is Zionism compatible with Palestinian sovereign statehood? And I think this has been the deeper crux of the issue. But we've had people like Begin and Nixon and de Klerk and the people in North Ireland. You've had Gorbachev. You've had statesmen in Israel and the Arab countries, Sadat and others, who have made really courageous decisions that reversed conventional wisdom, and they brought their people with them. So I think he could do it if there was a clear consensus among the Israeli people that they have to come to grips with the fact that Palestinians and Israelis have mutual, equal, and simultaneous rights to statehood and sovereignty, and those rights have to be implemented simultaneously, not sequentially, as has been the problem. The problem historically, I believe, has been that the American-Israeli combine, which has dominated this process, has always insisted that Israeli security and the tenets of Zionism have to be guaranteed before the Palestinians can then gradually enjoy their rights. And that process, in various ways, has been driving the peace negotiations, and has never worked. When the Egyptians and the Jordanians and the Israelis negotiated on simultaneous equal rights, simultaneously implemented, they both broke through and achieved peace, and those peace agreements have held. So I think it's a deeper question than just the political personality or the lineup of the day.
So do you think, Rami, that things are much different because President Obama is in the chair as opposed to some of his predecessors?
Yes, I think that's one of the differences. And Obama's personal commitment, I think, understanding of a commitment to an American role in a negotiated Arab-Israeli comprehensive peace is a new factor. The region has changed a lot. I mean, in the last 10 or 20 years, you look what's gone on in Lebanon with the strength of Hezbollah. You look at the Palestinian situation with Hamas and Fatah splitting up and Hamas running its own little statelet and Gaza. You see the gradual loss of credibility and even some legitimacy by Mahmoud Abbas, the rise of the Iranians in the region, the various forces that have been unleashed in the region through the Iraq war and other things. There's all kinds of new elements in the region. The whole regional situation has changed. And the United States has been fighting two wars in Afghanistan and Iraq and the Arab-Israeli conflict. I think the main reason the U.S. is pushing hard now is that Obama clearly understands that the continued Arab-Israeli conflict hurts the United States in the long run, as it hurts Palestinians and Israelis, obviously, but it also is becoming a really serious drag for the United States in so many different ways. And therefore, I think we're seeing all these things come together. Whether Obama can push now, bring people along with him and push as required on both sides remains to be seen. But he's really, I think it's, you have to really tip your cap to him to take this kind of step, you know, just before a midterm election goes very much against conventional wisdom in the U.S. that you don't do anything like this just before an election because the pro-Israeli groups will pressure you, et cetera, et cetera. But so I think we've got to acknowledge that there is a new spirit in the White House. There is a new attitude. The problem is it hasn't gone much beyond rhetoric for the last, you know, 18 months or so. But it's certainly new, and I think it's impressive. And this is the moment of reckoning coming up when we'll probably see more clearly what do the Americans have in mind, what are they willing to do, and what political risks are they willing to take.
David, how much of that do you agree with respect to U.S. interests at play here, as seen by President Obama, and that creating different conditions for Middle East peace talks than we've had in the past? And do you think, as I think Rami indicated at the end of his answer, that we're going to see some of the U.S. cards being played, whatever they may be, at the table today?
Yes, if I may, though, I just want to say one thing on what Rami said before about that the security being a guarantee was a prerequisite. I could not disagree with him more because the fact is Israel left Gaza and Lebanon, and you heard Netanyahu's remarks at the White House last night, each time got rockets. And what's happened is that the Israeli public is equating the idea of peace negotiations with greater vulnerability rather than greater security, even though the polls show they desperately want a two-state solution. And so the people are saying, well, if you don't like the book, why would you see the movie in the West Bank? The problem was security was not guaranteed. That's the whole problem, and they did it anyway. And that gives people like myself, who've been trying to work on the peace issue for a while, people keep, you know, saying Gaza, Lebanon, it's useless because you have, you know, Hamas and Hezbollah. People that Rami's speaking favorably about are the ones who are each time trying to destroy any chance for peace.
Let me linger on that for just a second and get both of your reactions before we come back to the Obama question to this clip that was on NPR's Morning Edition today. This is Naftali Bennett. He's a Jewish settler in what is called the Yisha Council. Let's listen.
What's going on in Washington is a farce. This is not peace. It's talking with terrorists that are determined to erase us from the earth. We're determined to stop that, and there's only one way to do that, and that's to build. There's only one language they understand, and that's strength and growth. And that's what we're going to do. We're going to grow strong.
Strength and growth. So, David Makovsky, that reflects what you were saying before, this feeling that when Israel withdrew from lands like in Gaza and Lebanon, the result was rockets. And so there's a public sentiment that to grow is to keep them safe, to shrink, if you will, is to keep them vulnerable.
Well, I don't think, you know, there's great public support for the settlers, and I certainly don't have sympathy for them, and I think they're totally wrong, completely wrong, in their approach. And I think that You know, but the problem is that the 90s, the reason why the violence was so potent was not just because Hamas knew at key junctures when to explode bombs, blowing people off of buses and pizzerias and discotheques, but the reason why it was so potent in the 90s was because Yasser Arafat was viewed as playing a double game, giving a green light to these attacks, viewing violence as a tool of negotiations. The good news here is that Abbas is not viewed like Arafat. He's not viewed as someone who is working hand in glove with the terrorists, and therefore I'm more hopeful. Here people will say, well, is he capable? And the good news in your intro to this whole segment, you said about the conditions being riper, and here Israel and the Palestinian Authority have been working beautifully for the last 3 years. There's been virtually no attacks. It's not just good for Israel. It's been good for the Palestinians, which polls show people feel safer in their homes, and that there's, according to the IMF, there's 11% growth in the West Bank at a time of a worldwide recession, a very severe one. So I tend to think that security is not just something that's good for Israel. It's been good for the PA economically, and it's the one thing that gives hope for these talks, and the security piece is integral. The settlers have their own view of this, and they're going to have to be dealt with. I think it's got to be clear that if they try to do settlements now, and there's now at least a moratorium till the 26th, they have to be stopped by the IDF, the Israeli Defense Forces. There's no two ways about it.
And Rami Kouri, what about Hamas on the other side in this regard? We talked about the strength of Netanyahu in Israeli political terms. Isn't Abbas much weaker in Palestinian terms? Hamas just killed 4 Israelis in a terrorist attack, I think, to take their place at the table in these talks, in effect. And Hamas has a lot of popular support as well. How can Abbas make a deal that gives up right of return or makes other compromises with Hamas out there as strong as it is?
Well, I mean, there's so many different issues here that have been raised, but if I could comment on them one by one quickly. The Hamas issue is, I mean, Hamas is not that strong. They probably get around 25% generally of the popular vote, and roughly about 25% of people probably support them normally. And that goes up and down. But they have a kind of veto power, because they represent the rejection of policies that Arafat and Abu Mazen, many people think, are policies that are just giving in to Israeli and American demands. So therefore, their role is exaggerated. They do, of course, they and others, Islamic Jihad and others, do use violence and terrorism, which they just did the other day. But this is not an isolated process. I mean, these guys use violence because the Israelis have been colonizing Palestinian lands for the last 40 years or so. So, I mean, to talk about the settlers as a freak group in Israel that's doing terrible things and should be controlled is a little bit, I think David is being slightly not giving the whole picture, because the Israeli government has been funding settlements and giving them incentives and financial guarantees and all kinds of things and military protection. So these settlers are not a bunch of freaks who are often doing crazy things on their own. The settlements have been done by the labor group and the Likud and everybody. So settlements are an integral part of the Israeli policy and Zionist work in the last 40 years. So you have to look at it in a broader sense. You have the settlers in Israel, you have Hamas and others who are much more militant on the Palestinian side, and they are players in both of their societies. Now, the key is not to focus on these minority groups, but to focus on the rights of the majority. The majority of Israelis, the majority of Palestinians want a negotiated, comprehensive peace that leads to two states. I think we know that clearly. David and I represent that sentiment of rational, centrist, peace-oriented, rights-based coexistence among Israelis and Palestinians. The problem is we've never figured out on both sides, the Israelis and Palestinians, have not figured out how to take that centrist majority and translate it into a diplomatic process. I just would add that the West Bank Gaza analogy that David gave, I think, also is incomplete, because, of course, Israel withdrew from West Bank and Gaza. From Lebanon and Gaza. They withdrew unilaterally. They didn't withdraw in a negotiation like they did with Egypt and Jordan, and therefore the war continued in other forums, and they got rockets sent at them because they were doing things in those areas, siege of Gaza, attacking people, and same as in Lebanon. So you have a war going on here, and to isolate one aspect of it and say, as Israelis do and Zionist propaganda does, that, well, you know, we got out of Gaza and all we got was rockets, I mean, that is just incomplete. It's just not accurate. It's a one-sided ideological view, which is great for some people if they want to present that view, but it's not an accurate picture of historical reality. The Israelis are not impartial observers in Gaza. The Israelis laid siege to it, they attack it, they control its water, they do all kinds of things. So if we're going to address this issue, we really need to look deeper at the fundamental rights of both sides, of the majorities on both sides, and figure out how do we achieve those? How do we implement those rights? And I would go back again and say that the Jordan and Egypt examples are tremendous examples, as Northern Ireland was and others, where you find people locked in a terrible conflict who actually solve it. And they solve it because they acknowledge the core demands of the other. We in the Arab world must acknowledge the core demands of the Israelis and even of Zionism to an extent, to say that the Jewish people must live in a state and peace and security in the Middle East, which they see as their ancestral homeland. We acknowledge that. They have to acknowledge the same to us, that the Palestinians were evicted or fled from their lands in 47-48. The refugee problem needs to be resolved according to international law. Security of a sovereign Palestinian state must be guaranteed. And therefore, in that approach, mutual and simultaneous rights of equal magnitude, I think, lies the path to a settlement that can be acceptable to both sides. I think it can be done. I don't know if Abu Mazen and Netanyahu are the people to do it. I kind of doubt it, but I think we have to explore every opportunity. We're morally obligated to explore every opportunity for a negotiated peace, but only if we do so with a combination of honesty and political clarity that can make that opportunity succeed.
We'll continue in a minute with Rami Khoury, public policy professor at the American University in Beirut and a columnist at the Daily Star there, and David Makovsky, director of the Project on the Middle East Peace Process at the Washington Institute for Near East Policy. Obviously, some things there in those answers that they will continue to disagree on, but we will look past those and go down the list of some of the particulars that came up, especially in Rami's last answer, about whether they can get to yes on some of these particular issues, like Jerusalem and the right of return and the status of Israel as a Jewish state. Are there the words that could lead Netanyahu and Abbas and Obama to yes on these issues in 2010? And listeners, we ask you too. Call in or post to our website. Is this the moment for a Middle East peace deal? And if you feel like a partisan on one side or another, what compromises should your side make today for your longer-term interests? 212-433-WNYC. Call us up. 212-433-9692. Is this the moment for a Middle East peace deal? Or post to WNYC.org. Click on Brian Lehrer Show. Brian Lehrer on WNYC, and as Abbas and Netanyahu sit with President Obama, we are sitting with Rami Khoury, public policy professor at the American University in Beirut and a columnist at the Daily Star of Lebanon, and David Makovsky, director of the Project on the Middle East Peace Process at the Washington Institute for Near East Policy. Let's take a phone call. And how about Jeffrey in Brooklyn? Jeffrey, you're on WNYC. Hello.
Hi. I heard what Mr. Khoury said. I think the right of return is definitely non-negotiable from Israel's point of view, because it would mean the end of the Jewish state. Jerusalem, I think, is also non-negotiable. It's the soul of the Jewish people for the last 3,000 years. But my question really is, if the Israelis can accommodate 1 million Palestinians, why couldn't the settlers, 300,000 of them, be accommodated in a future Palestinian government?
Do you think that's what they want? Stay on the land, but under the...
I think they would be willing to.
Well, that's interesting. David, do you think they would be willing to? Do you think as a minority in mostly Arab Palestine that the settlers want...
Go ahead.
I would say the following. I mean, we all want, I mean, where Rami and I would agree is that everyone is morally obligated to pursue every and untoned, you know, cover every stone for peace. And it's crucial, and therefore, I think was good. You know, sometimes these words are coded, but when Netanyahu said there's a partner for, you know, President Abbas, you're my partner for peace, that was critical because the Likud for many years during the Intifada, during the violence, says there was no partner. And so he last night, you know, made clear that he is putting an end to that whole talk. So what you want is a solution that gives, you know, dignity and respect for both sides. And if you don't have that sense of empathy with both and want something that works for both, it, you know, by definition, you're not going to have an agreement. So I think it's important, you know, to as a big picture, to understand what we're trying to reach. Now, in terms of the specific point about the settlers, I mean, I've done some work on this, and I'm going to be releasing a study shortly, having studied maps and how would you do equal trade-offs, what they call land swaps, that Israel would keep some areas adjoining to Israeli cities, largely near the old pre-67 border, that Israel would give certain other lands. What you find out if you do the arithmetic is that 240 of the 300,000 settlers, and I'm not including Jerusalem in this because Israel doesn't call them settlers, but if you want to include the East Jerusalemites in that, so instead of 240 out of 300,000, it's like 440 out of 500,000, an overwhelming majority, just purely West Bank, 80%. Would be something they live, 80% of the settlers live in less than 4.5% of the land, largely adjacent to the pre-67 lines. And therefore, you could have land swaps whereby Israel will keep them, annex these people, annex that land, but in turn give other land. Now, the question would be, what about the remaining 60,000 people? Could those people remain in Palestinian areas? I've talked to some of them. I can't say I spoke to all of them, but I've seen polls. Most of them, you know, came to live there because they want to live in the land of Israel and under, you know, the Jewish sovereignty. And I tend to believe that they don't want to live in Palestine.
They would have
there
to
might
move,
be a
really,
handful
right?
that might. Mm-hmm. And those discussions should go right. on, but
the rest of them would have to move, right?
Right, but those 60,000 would probably have to move. Would those who want to stay, could accommodations be found? Perhaps. In theory, it sounds nice. Here's the problem with it. And people will say, well, Israeli Arabs live in Israel, but doesn't have the Palestinian Authority security services protecting them. You know, if you live in Israel, you live in Israel. And that would be the same if you lived in Palestine. Mm-hmm. You'd have to live under the authority. And my fear is that you would have radicals like Hamas viewing the settlers as like the arch enemy because they associate them with the land. And there may be some incidents, and that would suck the Israeli army back in. So I think you'd have some kind of ideological minefields. In theory, it should be able to be worked out. We shouldn't preclude that as a possibility. But I've talked to some of the settlers who want to stay, and the question is if their intentions are peaceful. And right. with the Palestinians, 100% of them, 99% might be peaceful, but not all of them, and there could be an incident, and then Israel would not be able to withstand the television mm-hmm. images of any incident, and then would end up going right back in again. So I'm not sure of that scenario. I've heard people talk about it. I wouldn't, discount it, but I think it would have to be done very, very carefully.
Rami, I know you have to go shortly. To even broaden that answer, we talked about the conventional wisdom that this is not the right time for a peace deal, but that maybe it is. There's another conventional wisdom that says the details of a peace agreement are actually already known, and it's basically the deal that they almost signed at the end of the Clinton administration. 95% or something like that of the West Bank with some land swaps, as David was describing, to give Israel some of the Jerusalem suburbs with so much Jewish population and the other adjacent to the 67 lines land, and to give Palestinians in the land swaps a contiguous state. plus a right of return for refugee families to Palestine but not to Israel, perhaps with cash payments to refugee families in the mix, some kind of power sharing or division of land in Jerusalem, and Palestinian promises to disarm Hamas and others who would still like to fight on that side. How true is that conventional wisdom, that there is basically a 20-year-old deal ready to sign and all that's needed is everybody's political will?
Well, I think a lot of it is true, but not all of it. What you outlined were some pretty much the Clinton parameters. Many other Track 2 meetings have come up with similar broad outlines. These have never been presented to or ratified by either the Israeli people or the Palestinian people. They were negotiated by politicians who were under terrible stress and time pressures and other things. So I think the reality is that those parameters, in my view, knowing the Palestinians and the Israelis as I do, I think there is a middle ground there where people can reach an agreement. So I would say, yes, probably 80-85% of what has to be negotiated, we can see where the agreements will come. But my concern is that the two critical issues for both sides have not been fully resolved or even seriously addressed, which is what the Israelis absolutely desperately want most and need, and they have a right to, is recognition by the Arabs and the Palestinians of their right to exist as a predominantly Jewish state in what they consider their ancestral homeland, in peace, sovereignty, and security, and normal relations. They have not received that fully. They've gotten it conditionally in the Arab peace plan. They need that. What the Palestinians need, and the Arabs as well, but especially the Palestinians, is an Israeli acknowledgement of how Palestinians became refugees, how a land that was 90% Arab, Muslim, Christian became 80% Jewish in the last 70, 80 years. How is it that the Palestinians found themselves in exile, refugee, dispersed all over the world? And in other words, how the Palestinian people became refugees, and how what was done to them by the Israelis, by their own fault and other people, by the international community, the Palestinians must have acknowledgement of what happened to them.
Rami, are you saying that separate and apart from any material conditions on the ground for today and for the future for the Palestinians, that they need an expression of some kind of culpability on the Israeli side for running them off the land and creating the refugee situation, a verbal sort of mea culpa for something that happened 60 years ago and more?
Well, the short answer to that is yes, but it has to be negotiated between them, and this is something that the Israelis and the Palestinians have to do in the negotiations. Jeffrey mentioned the right of return. I never used that phrase. The refugee issue must be resolved according to international law, but negotiated between the Israelis and the Palestinians. This is the critical importance of the Arab peace plan of 2002, that we are, and the Palestinian leadership has said this repeatedly, we will negotiate how the final resolution of the refugee, of the Palestinian refugee issue, takes place, that Israel will remain predominantly a Jewish state as it is now. The idea that, you know, Israel commits suicide by taking back 4 or 5 million Palestinians is politically not on the table, I don't think. Now, some people still say they want all the refugees to return. The reality is this has to be negotiated, but it has to be negotiated in a way that satisfies the Israeli demand for a predominantly Jewish state that is recognized and satisfies the Palestinian demand for an Israeli acknowledgement of what happened in 1947-48 in order to pave the way for the compromises needed to find those different mechanisms, giving options to the refugees, some of which would return, some of whom would return to Israel, some would West Bank Gaza, some would stay where they are, some would go to other countries, compensation, restitution, third country resettlement, all statehood, all kinds of possibilities will become available. But this has to be negotiated. I believe it can be. Like David's been doing research, so have I, and I've got a piece coming out soon which looks at the Israeli and the Palestinian deep issues about what does the other side need, each side need from the other, what are they willing to give? I believe that it's this non-material aspect. It's not land. It's not money. It's an acknowledgement of what one side did to the other and what one side is willing to say to the other to live with it in peace. It may include acknowledging responsibility. It may include expressing regret. It may include apology, asking for forgiveness, a whole range of issues which they will negotiate if they really had courage and honesty. I mean, this is what the people in Northern Ireland did and South Africa and others. This is how you resolve these conflicts. This is not about money or land. This is about what David mentioned, the word human dignity. It's the rehumanization of both sides in the eyes of the other. Mm. And the Israelis, if you want to end this conflict, you have to go back to where it started. It started in 47, 48. Actually started before, but 47, 48 is where it started, on both sides. Arabs not recognizing Israel's Jewish statehood demands, and Israel not recognizing that the Palestinians should live there as an integral community, and drove many of them out, and others fled them. So these are issues that are very complicated, but they're deeply powerful. They reach into the gut, core, heart, and soul of every Palestinian and every Israeli and maybe every Jewish person. That's where the key to this resolving this conflict lies, I believe. And then the technical issues will be much easier to resolve once there is that core acknowledgement of recognition on both sides simultaneously.
Rami Khoury from the Daily Star and the American University in Beirut, thank you so much for joining us today. I know you have to go.
And pleasure. Thanks for having me.
We still have David Makovsky from the Washington Institute for Near East Policy for another couple of minutes. And let me get one more phone caller in here, and that's Ahmed in Woodside. Ahmed, you're on WNYC. Hello.
Yes, hello. I like your show. I have a comment here for America and for Obama. It's a great opportunity to go through the deal. But is that the strategy to keep talking, but never achieve anything? The peace talk is stopped.
Ahmed, I get the question, and because of the beeping in the background, I'm going to leave it there. And David Makovsky, when he says the strategy to keep talking but never achieve a peace, this is what some people say Netanyahu is up to, because he wants the United States to have good relations with him so he can be as strong as necessary against Iran, which Israel is really afraid of, developing nuclear weapons, and even attack an Iranian bomb factory if it comes to that, while not necessarily doing anything but stalling, keeping these talks going for a year and never coming to a two-state solution that he doesn't really believe in. Do you think that might be the scenario from Netanyahu's standpoint?
Look, I tend to think the history of this conflict shows that when there's a chance for peace, the Israeli public is the one that presses its leaders to optimize and punishes those same leaders if they don't optimize the prospects for a deal. The peace with Egypt, the peace with Jordan, at different moments in the Palestinian negotiations of the 90s, when the Israelis feel that there's quiet and there's hope, they demand that their leaders go for progress. When they start getting blown up, it becomes a different story. I think that they put this one-year cap on the talks for now. Some wonder if it's realistic, the whole thing. But Netanyahu, at a speech at the Council of Foreign Relations in New York City in July, endorsed that approach. So sometimes timetables do kind of concentrate the mind, and I think that's useful. I would just add, if we're going to get to that 1 year, and I think on borders and security there's a real chance. I mean, your listeners do not know this, but the difference is the last round between Israelis and Palestinians over the land was 4% difference. That's it. And so I think that there's a real chance here. And Netanyahu tried to address a lot of the skeptics in the last night. But the point here is, and this gets to Rami's point, Brian, about how is conditioning the public on the two narrative issues of this conflict, and that is Jerusalem and refugees. And this is the part that scares me, is that I feel that until you condition the societal landscape for compromise, the odds are if they don't do that, there is no compromise. What Rami suggests is an interesting approach of getting people to articulate about the past. Sometimes in the Middle East, I think the past is harder to solve than the future.
Yeah, we have just 30 seconds. Do you agree with him about the centrality of reckoning with history in order to get to yes?
I think in principle he's right. It's complex because the Israeli position is very clear, which is there would have been no refugees in 1948 if all the Arab states wouldn't have launched a war on Israel the very day it was born. So it's a complicated thing. I think if you could sort through it, I think it would be very cathartic, and I think there's something to what he says. I don't think apology, culpability are the right words, but some sort of reckoning with the past, but to be done in a very nuanced way that both sides feel that there's been justice done to the past. I hope that they could solve the past, but like I said, it might be easier to solve the future, but I think it might be worth a try.
David Makovsky, director of the project on the Middle East peace process at the Washington Institute for Near East Policy. We'll see what they come out with in terms of a public statement later today. Thank you very much for joining us and having
delighted to be with you, Brian.
Complex conversation. Coming up next, we will begin a September higher education series with New York Times higher education reporter Tamar Lewin. Today, what are those for-profit colleges that you see advertised on the subway, and are they worth the price of tuition? Stay tuned.